I'ma say what I feel, and I promise to keep it real.
Welcome to the Red Room. Boom, 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 boom. Yeah. So you wanna be a rider? Well, you gotta be a rider till your fears are diminished and the doubts are behind ya. It's hard to grind and the business got me stressed in the Red Room. We let that shit up off our chest. You know the street nerd has got no time for no caca. Sass in class, yes, that's Mr. Bolakaja. Never have to guess when you're listening to Hilliard. He gon' bring more game than a shark playing billiards. It's all about the crap of screenwriting. It's exciting when you turn an outline into something enlightening. Your pen and words are like bullets in a gun. Write what you feel, say what you want. Welcome to the Red Room.
What's up, y'all? It's your boy, Hilliard Guest, and you guys are listening to the Screenwriters Rant Room. Where we keep it real, we keep it opinionated, we keep it what, y'all? Wakanda. You know how we do it, Brandon. On this show, we discuss entertainment, TV, film, music, culture, but our focus is always screenwriting, stories, craft, and shit like that. Little disclaimer, Lisa Bolakaja is out, but she will be back next week.
Okay, he was like going crazy.
I know,
everybody. In San Diego. Just like crazy.
You see all the shit on her?
No, what happened?
Oh, dude, they were out there marching and going crazy at the theater.
The theater down there.
They had like the bongos going.
It sold out, and they're all like in their like full regalia.
Full regalia. All right. They're either in their... in their cosplay, or they were in like some African garb. And the dreads were out. Mm. You know what I mean? It was crazy. So shout out to Lisa Bolakaja. But sitting in with us today, we got my man, Chris Derrick from the writing directing team, the Derrick Brothers. What's up, Chris?
Not much, man.
Yeah.
Excited. It's just, I'm still kind of like in the glow.
You on that new TV show? Is that what it is? Out there just wrestling the girls and shit.
Well, you know, I like to wrestle girls at times because.
And then we got my man, Brandon Easton. We haven't had you here in a while.
Yeah,
writer, producer himself. What's going on?
I am good. Glad to be back and still living off of the afterglow of Black Panther of Wakanda.
Yes.
I am just taking it easy, man. It's a beautiful day, and I'm very happy to be here.
So let's just ask you right quick before we get into it. So what you been up to lately since last time we talked to you? It's like about a year now since we...
It's been almost 8, 9 months. Well, you know, I had a very interesting 2017, as many of us did in the business.
Right.
But, you know, my comic book stuff is still flowing pretty well. And
let's tell the kids a little bit about it. What you got going on?
Well, okay. In the last year, I've been working with Jeff Thorne on a project over at Marvel, which I can't obviously talk about, and that's going to drop real soon.
Mm-hmm.
And I finished up with Mobile Armored Strike Command, also known as MASC, over at IDW.
Mm-hmm.
And the Vampire Hunter D graphic novel is going to be coming out later this year. We had to go get a new artist, but it looks absolutely outstanding.
All right.
And then I was hired by a production company to write a pilot to adapt a, you know, major international franchise into American television. Yeah,
give me some of that. That's what I'm talking about.
So
Where my 10% at? Where my pimp fees at?
We shall see. We shall see, my friend.
I've seen you talk about that on Facebook, and I'm very, very curious to see what it is, because I remember you posted a couple of weeks ago that you turned it in and were excited about it.
Yeah, turned an outline.
And I was like, okay, I want to know, but you can't.
I mean, I can't. Yeah. It's going to drop soon. I just did the interview for a magazine, and what's going to happen is it's going to drop probably in the first week of March.
Okay.
So when that happens, I'll be happy to make that announcement. But a couple of my friends, and I do have to say this for anyone who might be listening who's hiring, just because I have comic book work does not mean I don't want TV writing.
Right.
People keep coming up to me saying, I thought you were okay. I have not worked in 2 years on a television series, live action television series. So yes, while my comic book career is flowing, I still need to get staff someplace. So I just want to put that out there because I keep talking to people and they keep saying, oh, I thought you were staffed. I'm like, yeah, I'm writing comics. Not television. I'm staffed because of my own accord in comics.
Right.
But as you know, in TV, it's not always just your efforts. It has to be a perfect storm of all the right things happening.
Well, let me ask you this, because I would think, you know, because you have reps now.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah, I still do.
I mean, this is interesting. We'll shift into the fucking Black Panther in a minute.
Yeah, sure.
But this is, people need to hear this shit.
Sure, go
You know me. I like to talk about this
shit. Yeah, yeah.
So... you come off a show, which was a genre show, right?
Yes.
Marvel.
Agent Carter.
Agent Carter.
Yeah.
And then you don't work for 2 years.
Right.
real shit.
Yes.
Right? Real shit, right? So here's the interesting thing. You are like the genre dude to the 100th degree.
Right.
Right? You do fucking comic books, graphic books. Yes. I mean, there's nothing else you can't do.
Right.
How in the world could somebody like you, with your wisdom and knowledge in the fucking comic book world, and there's like 30 fucking shows on the air that are in the genre that you could write.
Right.
Why the fuck can't you write?
I don't know. According to some people who... I was attacked on Twitter last year.
Really?
Yeah.
Whatever.
And it was a woman, and she was saying that I was... can I curse?
Did you just hear me fucking a minute ago?
She called me a, and I don't know why she attacked me, but she called me a know-it-all asshole who nobody wants in their room. And I was like, really? Because I haven't done anything to anybody. I was like being.
Was she, is she in the industry or was she just?
She's a black woman writer who attacked me on Twitter for absolutely no reason, really.
Wow.
And like, I thought we were having a discussion that was lighthearted, but she was starting to drop like real nasty bombs on me. I mean, nasty. I mean, she was just calling me all these names and saying I was mansplaining and I'm a know-it-all asshole and all this stuff. What? And I never met this. To this day, I've never met this woman.
Wow.
And but I ran into a friend of mine at Black Panther who tells me, oh, all these people know who you are and they think you're cool and all that. And I'm like, why am I not being hired?
Right.
So, and I don't, and the thing is, and I spoke to a couple of people, I'm like, I don't talk about that publicly too much. I'm not, because I don't want to complain or seem like I'm saying, why aren't you hiring me? I'm just like trying to figure out, you know, what it is I need to do to enhance my chances. Mm-hmm. I mean, some of my early problems, particularly in 2016, especially in 2016, were, and I hate to say it publicly, but it was rep problems.
Mm-hmm.
I was being
Sometimes you have rep problems.
Sure. I was being thrown against a wall to see what stuck instead of being properly introduced to the right people. Mm-hmm. And I feel that one thing, and I say this to all reps, and I've asked this question, never gotten a straight answer, but I do feel that if you have a writer of color, particularly an African-American male writer, you know, not putting their color at the front of your spiel is probably, you know, I feel like...
Do you think it's hard for them?
Well, I'll say this much. When I did say that to them, I was told later by people, you know, all our friends, they were like, well, you can't say that to reps because then they think that you're calling them racist or you're saying something wrong. When all I was saying was, hey, this is how you could actually pitch me. I work with JPL/NASA. You know, I was a former history teacher of economics and, you know, U.S. history.
Educated, smart motherfucker. Right.
Well, but I say that for a reason that in your spiel, these are things that should be front loaded.
Right.
You know, also my comic book career, which I was told by one of my former reps that nobody cared that I was a comic book writer.
What?
They actually told, and I didn't, and I had no reason to disbelieve
her. You write genre. Of course they fish about. But
I mean, she said flat out, nobody cares that you do this. And I was like, really? And she's like, yes. And she was dead serious. And I took it to heart because I was like, I had to believe her because I trusted I didn't sign with somebody I didn't trust. Yeah. I just felt like my trust ultimately was misplaced. So when you add in, in fact, I also came out to the Disney ABC program. And you also know, and we all know, that people who come out of these programs don't always get staffed again because first of all, nobody wants to pay for you, you know, and I talked to a bunch of black male showrunners who I know, and it's like there's been a shift away from staff writers, period. Like, period. Not even just black ones, but people don't want to hire – people just don't want to groom writers or hire staff writers. Right. So there was
very top-heavy now.
Right, right. As you know, we all know that now. But basically, to sum it up, I think I had a slew of – all the wrong things happening at the right time, at the wrong time. You know what I mean? So
timing is everything.
Right.
Timing is
everything. As you know, to get staffed, all the right things, like a slew of positive things have to go right at the right, things have to break your direction. Right. You know, it could be simple as like if you're watching baseball and if a ball goes underneath the first baseman's glove, like what happened with the Red Sox in 86, I believe it was, you know, that happens to our careers too. It could be as simple as not being at the Writers Guild at the right moment.
Right.
Or not being in the garage at the right moment.
Right.
Do you know how many impactful conversations for my career I've had in the garage of the Writers Guild of America West?
A lot. I believe it.
Yeah.
A
you
lot.
Know what I mean? I'm just throwing it out there.
No. So, I think people, you know, people miss those opportunities to want to talk to people when they're leaving. And when they're not, you know, I mean, it's different to leave. It's different to talk after the panel than it is to talk in the garage, you know, like right upstairs and then down in the basement. Because in the basement, I think they feel a little more less who's listening,
who's watching.
You know, right.
Well, let's explain that. So what you're basically saying, are you talking about panelists or are you talking about just even people in the audience?
Everything.
So we're talking about if you go to a panel, for instance, at the Writers Guild or wherever you would go, sometimes when you go back to your car and there's other people out there or at the elevator, you start a conversation and you don't ever know who you're starting a conversation with, right?
Mm-hmm.
Just trying to paint the picture for the people a little
sure.
bit. And you're also saying sometimes it's a panelist.
Well, right? Well, no. Okay, this is what I'm saying. Like I'm saying is that after the panel, the panelists get mobbed by everybody there and wants to talk to them.
I never speak to them.
And then, unless it's someone that I know already, I'll say, hey, man, good seeing you. I'll hit you up on email tomorrow.
Right.
You know, because I don't want to take your time. And you know what? And guess what? You can't give me time right now anyway. Right. It's like you're the host, you can't right. you don't have time. But you wanted them in the garage when no one's around,
right.
they'll give you time.
Right.
I remember one time happened when we were watching Southpaw at the Writers Guild, and I didn't know what the hell's his name. He wrote fucking he did Sons of Anarchy.
Kurt Sutter.
Kurt Sutter. He wrote that, and he was in a talk afterwards. And he was so bitter about the movie because they had changed so much of it.
Right. He hates that.
Yeah, you know. And yeah, so I was Kurt like, very well. You know, the people walk up to him afterwards, and the thing, and never. I said, I know him tangentially through Glenn, but I didn't want to say anything. And then, but then I was outside waiting for my car to come up, and he walked by.
Right.
I said, Kurt. Hey, you know, blah, blah, blah. He was like, huh? And he didn't know me, but he gave me that opportunity then, and he gave me and my brother some time that he wouldn't have given us, like, in there when the whole theater was mobbing him and stuff like that.
Right.
That's what I think people have to – I mean, and that's your timing thing.
Right.
And that's that you might not be able to, like – you can't guarantee that's going to happen. But when it does, be prepared to, like, take advantage of it.
Well, you just got me thinking about something. People always ask me why they always sit in the front row. Every time you see me, there's an event, I'm in the front row. Well – when I sold my first script in 2004, and in 2006, I started doing all these panels, right? I was on them because we had this horror script I wrote, right? So I'd be on panels, and I'd sat down. I'll never forget. I was sitting. I was looking at the audience. I realized, and you guys have all been on panels too, you can only see the first two rows.
Right.
And maybe some heads deep in the back if it's at a thing. So I went, oh, I don't even remember anybody else except for the people I see sitting right here.
Staring right at you.
So that's part one. The other part is me being a black man, I'm not sitting in the fucking back.
Right.
So that's me.
I agree with that.
Right? Yeah. So it helped me to put my face on things. People remember those people more. Because they constantly are looking. If they're not speaking, they're just looking out, and they're looking at the first row or two. You know?
Right.
So, and the other part is, whenever I did do those and people come swarming to you after the panel, I don't hardly remember any of those people. Because I'm just going, hey, nice to meet you. Hey, nice to meet you. Hey, nice to meet you. So you guys are right on the button. To some extent, you're almost wasting your time. To some extent. To just a little extent. If you're not making a definite connection.
You have to figure that. You have to know how to make the connection.
Right.
And I will say that, I mean, like, that's how I met Glenn. I really wanted to meet him because I had seen his name on like a bunch of shows that I loved, like Life and on The Shield. And then he was at this panel, and I was like, I want to meet this guy. Like, not just meet him, but I want to form some sort of connection with him.
Right.
So afterwards, everyone was talking to him, and I said, hey, man. And it was this thing about like how to write like a perfect, not like a perfect, but like how to make, it was something about like writing a great spec.
Mm.
And I said, hey.
I think I was there.
Hey, I got a great spec. I would love for you to read it, but I know it's a big ask. If you just read the first 10 pages and then if you're not interested, don't call me back and I'm not going to call you.
That's not asking too much.
And then he said to me, okay, here's my email. Send it to me.
Wow.
Right.
Because I said it's just 10 pages and I'm not going to hound you about it. I was very clear about that. And then he called me like about a month later, but he said, I read your whole script. And I was like, but at that time I felt confident enough in the material.
Right.
You know, but I also was not going to say, you know, I mean, because I know that if writers don't like your shit, they're going to stop at page 10 anyway.
Right.
You know?
This is true.
So
this
I was like, look. And so. But that's, I think, the only time that I've done that, because there's other people that I want to meet, but at times where I'm like, I don't know what, I can't do that with them. You know, I want something different or things like that.
Because you have to give them the right material,
too. Yeah.
You know, for the right person.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Right. And it's threading the needle, just like everything in this business is like threading the needle.
Right. Right.
And like you're saying, if the reps aren't even giving you thread, then you can't. What are you gonna do?
I tell you, man. I mean, I honestly felt like I had done something wrong. I committed some cardinal sin because I felt that every door was shut, and then I ran into Jeff Bird, who I'll shout out. Thank you.
What's up, Jeff?
At Black Panther on Thursday, and he's. Was like, dude, you know, all these people know who you are and blah, 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 blah. And I'm like, then I don't understand why I'm not being, you know. Right. And it's a thing where I'm not angry. I was angry. I am completely not angry anymore. I've gotten over it. I mean, I was just like, for basically 18 months, I was like, I don't understand what's happening.
Yeah.
But the thing I did was go back to the drawing
board. I have to interrupt you.
Sure.
Because this is real shit. So trip this. So you work your ass off. You get into one of the programs. You get on a show.
Yes.
And you're like, okay, God has said, here you go. For like 20 weeks. Right.
Pretty much.
And then you're like, and then boom, it's cut off. And you're like, wait a minute, God, I thought you said I was in now.
Right.
Right. Or whoever That's you believe in, works. Whatever the fuck. Right. So you are just like on a high to a low, on a high to a low.
Right.
So keeping that balanced is difficult. So your first reaction, like when you break up with your girlfriend, your wife, whoever the fuck, is to get angry.
Right.
Right.
Right. Yeah.
You feel
me,
Chris?
You live it.
Look, you're angry. There's a whole lot of self recrimination.
Right. Right.
There's all this
questions.
Shit. Yeah.
Right. Unanswered questions.
What did I do? How did I fuck this up?
Right. What did I do? Exactly.
Right. I was fucking her right. I thought I was fucking. Right. You know, it's all like I said that you have to. You
start. I was the first one there and the last one to leave. What are you talking about?
Like, what's going on? And it's not in your head. And it's like. There's just so much stuff you're not told. There's so many things that are going on.
Right.
I mean, there's things that
That's politics.
Right.
Politics. It's like you saying that about the woman on Twitter hitting you. Didn't even know you.
Right.
But there's something said about you.
Right.
Because it's like...
She directly attacked me. Like, it was the weirdest shit ever. To this day, I'm still like, what the fuck happened?
Because I can't remember when like you and I met, but we met one time at the Writers Guild.
Yeah,
we were talking. I can't remember what it
was. We were upstairs.
I remember you. And we walked into a panel. And I was saying to myself... You remind me of like a bunch of guys who I grew up with, who I used to hang out with at the comic book store,
you know?
And at the time, I knew your name from stuff you've written and stuff. I just seen your name. And I was like, okay, so you're a cool guy. But the thing that see, now you're telling me the story that people think you're a know-it-all, blah, 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 and you have this background in history. And I realized is that a lot of times, people in your situation, because this happens to me a lot too, I could just kind of tell, this is the thing, who you are, which makes you fascinating, makes certain people intimidated.
And insecure.
Right.
And insecure.
Which I don't understand.
Therefore, they have to find these ways to see, because look, I could probably like say to you, Brandon, so... in 1985, there was this, you know, like Fantastic Four, that blah blah, blah. You probably know it.
Yeah. He's like volume number 34.
You probably know what I was talking about exactly.
Probably
right?
About John Byrne. Yeah. It was 1985.
Yeah, things, right? But if someone was listening, they probably say, "You're a know-it-all.
You're a prick for knowing things."
you know what it is? Is that people think that you're showing off your special gift.
Right.
And they don't like that's your gift, and therefore and the thing is, it's not you showing off. Mm-hmm. It's you just being you.
I have and this is my thing. Do people say that about white men? Like if a white guy is smart or a white woman is smart, they're like, "Wow, that guy, you know, they're smart. They're an asset to a room." A black guy who's
Einstein's cousin, isn't it?
You know, but it's like I don't ever wear any of my academics or whatever you want academia on my sleeve. I just talk and I treat everybody the same.
Right.
I don't treat, and I swear to God, I don't. I treat men, women, whoever. I don't care who you are, as long as you treat me with dignity and respect, I'll give it back to you. But I find, and of course, and this is something no one talks about, but I do believe at one point my weight was working against me.
Okay.
I was at 370.
Okay.
And now I'm at 270, basically.
Wow. Yeah. Come on, boy.
Thank you, brother.
You look great.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And I did notice that, because this is something no one ever talks about, is the fat phobia that exists.
Let's get it.
And I do feel that in this city, and obviously, you know, I don't get out. I mean, my other problem, I don't go out enough. Like, I really don't go out out socially enough. And that's also hurt me. I know that hurts me.
Right.
And I know that's been an issue. But you know, I do know based on what some people have said, and when I was working on shows and stuff, that me being as heavy as I was, people definitely wanted to keep me at a. It's a way people treat you without them realizing it. Mm. Where if you're really, really heavy, there's certain assumptions made. Now, I wasn't aware of this until I had a conversation with a white, blonde-haired, blue-eyed guy who used to be heavy too. Mm. And I thought, well, is it just the intersection between race and cellulite that's right. hurting me, you know? But then I talked to this white guy, works at a production company right down the street, I'm not going to say which one, and he said, oh, no, my former boss told me he didn't trust fat people because he felt they had no self-control and he couldn't have anybody without self-control in his office.
Wow.
And it was like, well, my reason I was heavy wasn't because I didn't have self-control. It's because I was working three jobs and ate garbage at night every night
right.
before I went to bed.
Right.
That's where I gained the most amount of weight when I moved here because
that's
I
was, when you gain the most right before you go to bed, too.
Right. And the trick is I was stressed. I was working. I was trying to make my dream come true. Mm-hmm. And the flip side of it was I put on a lot of weight right. and then people were judging me for right. it. So now it's also interesting on a sociological level to see how people treat me after the fact.
Mm. I've heard that, you know, too. There's a friend of mine who's
like, oh, right.
Yeah.
That's real.
There are people who knew, because every time I walk in, sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off real quick. No, yeah. But every time I walk into a room with people who knew me beforehand, first now, let me backtrack. When I meet people now, I don't feel that weirdness. And it's not just me projecting. I can tell when someone's keeping me at, with a stick, you know, tell. We all know when people, you can tell. Then the people who knew me have known me for years now and they see me, but there's been a lapse in them seeing me. They are so much nicer to me now. And they're so much like congratulatory and everyone's like waving a flag. Oh my God, you know, I'm like, you weren't nice to me back then. I mean, there was somebody when I was on the set of Agent Carter who was a complete asshole to me the whole time. And then she runs up to me after the fact and was like, oh, we're all one. Like, she actually used the word family to describe that crew. And I'm like, you were a complete dick to me on set. I'll give you an example. We were in Santa Clarita. We were shooting at a place called Mystery Mesa, where so many action, it's like a death, you know what I'm talking about? Mystery Mesa is known for several things. One, it's incredible views. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is 100-mile-per-hour dust storms that come out of nowhere. So we were out on the shooting. It was 6 a.m. We were shooting an Agent Carter scene. And a 90-mile-per-hour wind came up over the camp.
Ooh, that's
kicked
strong.
Up all this dirt.
Right.
Now, this person who was so much, was my family now, she gave everybody goggles except for me.
What?
Wow.
Yeah, she walked around and gave goggles, and I'm sitting there just had my glasses on. Which
and you there to produce your episode, right?
I was the writer, and she would not even give me goggles. And I had suffered a bunch of little indignities like that during the course of that show, but I let it go because it was my first show, and I was terrified of every little thing, and I didn't know, and I just wanted to make sure that I did my contribution, and I didn't make any waves because as a black guy, I've been told by hundreds of black men,
the brother who's over 6 feet,
that you need to make sure that you're there early. Like the same rules they give everybody are doubly in place for us.
Double it.
You know, be there early, leave late.
Right.
I offered to do all this extra stuff, which wasn't needed, but I wanted to flesh out the world because as a world builder, I was offering to write backstories for certain characters that needed, because it's stuff that you never see on screen, but you miss it if it ain't there. You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
So, I mean, to put a cap on it, I honestly don't know what it is. I don't know what I did. I don't know what people think, but I know that when I meet everybody, I mean, I don't mistreat anybody. Mm-hmm. I treat everybody the same. Right. Now, I know that there's some weirdness sometimes with the sisters and brothers in this town. And because I had it happen where I had a conversation with a black woman writer. This is not the one who called me a know-it-all asshole. This is someone else who is an accomplished public relations sister. And her whole approach to everything is all black men here only want to sleep with white women. And I'm like, that's not true at all. But if that's what you believe, but I'm like, you shouldn't walk around with that in your head because when I go to the gym, all I see is brothers trying to talk to sisters who will not talk back to them.
Right.
You know, I mean, if anyone thinks that black men in this town don't like black women, you need to go to 24-hour fitness anywhere in this city, especially in Carson where I go.
Right.
Brothers love black women. I don't know if it goes the other way sometimes in this town because I keep hearing that brothers don't like black women here, but I'm like, that's not what I see. That's not what I feel. That's not what I hear. So I don't know where this mentality is coming from, but I'm getting all these vibes that there's like a little bit of weirdness between brothers and sisters. I know there's definitely weirdness toward overweight people, but in terms of me, I don't know anything I've done to any one person other than show up and work really hard every day. Right. So I don't know what happened. I know, like, for example, a couple people over at, Legends of Tomorrow wanted to read my one of my specs, but they were looking for a more comedic writer. Right. So I didn't have a lot of comedy in the spec, but they liked the spec. They were like, well, this is dope. Like, you're doing the right thing. Yeah. This is good work. Mm-hmm. And everybody who I meet will be like, whoa, that was a dope script. I got a lot of meetings, but they don't turn always into jobs, as we all know. Right. Now, one of the things that happened to me, which was the first time ever, I went up for a job over at Sony mm-hmm. for a science fiction show, and what I found out after the fact that it was basically the new showrunner who was brought in, he kept finding something wrong with everything I gave him. Hmm. Like, it was always something. It
so
was
you
always,
sent him more than one thing.
Yeah, which I found once you have to do that is usually a wrap.
Right.
But what I found out after the fact was it wasn't me at all. He just wanted to hire his buddies from the old show right. he was on. But right. I was made to think for that whole 2.5 month period of me jumping through hoops that I was a shitty writer.
Mm.
Because I didn't have, in the absence of any other information, I'm reverting to it's me. Because right. I don't have any other, you know, evidence. And I don't want to just speculate. It's like, oh, it's just racism. No. Sometimes they just don't want to hire you because they want to hire their buddies. Right.
They're trying to stall time, too.
Right. Right. And but by me being the person that they use to stall time, that affected me.
Right.
And that's another thing I wanted, because I had a meeting with some people, and we talked about this very subject, that these are people's, this is our lives. Mm-hmm. This is not just a slot. This is people's dreams and their lives. And when you play with them, you're hurting people, and you're doing more than just hurting them financially. You're also messing with their self-esteem a little bit. Mm-hmm. And it's taken me a few years to even, I'm from Baltimore. I had a tough skin before I even got here.
Right.
You know, I taught in the Bronx and one of the worst neighborhoods. I just did a pilot about my,
good.
You know,
oh,
my,
I wanna read
and
that,
and that ended up being the, I became a semi-finalist in the TV writer, the WGA TV Writer Access Project, okay, yeah. just on that script, right. which is funny because that script, which I have not touched since I finished the second or third draft, that was what kind of broke up me and my former manager.
Oh, really?
Management.
They didn't want you to write that show?
No, they said it wasn't good. They said it because basically, this, I'll tell you real fast.
Tell again.
What happened to me at the end of 2016, because after I came off Agent Carter, I was a free agent. I was very hot. I was in the Hollywood Reporter 3 times in 2016.
I remember, yes.
You know,
yes.
I had all this stuff going on. And I kept sending stuff to my former reps being like, there has to be something you right. can do with all this heat and traction.
It's not like you need to get a PR person, really.
So they said, okay, so then staffing season of 2016 came and went for network. Yeah. And so we hit July and we hit Comic-Con. That's when shit hit the fan, actually right. Comic-Con of 2016. And I was told that, this is why I was told nobody cares, I was a writer, a comic book writer. Hmm. And then I was told.
At Comic-Con.
Yeah, it was the week after, because I came back and I was like hustling and dealing at Comic-Con. Right. But then my former reps were like, you know, not feeling it. They were right. just like, we didn't make any money off of you in this one little brief period wow. of time, so fuck you, basically.
Damn.
They didn't say that, but that was the vibe. Yeah. So that was my agents who I broke up with after Comic-Con. Mm-hmm. So then I still had this former management. Right. And they were like, well, you need to write something dark and heavy and character-based. That's your voice that you actually give a shit about. Because you can tell when someone's writing something they really don't give a fuck about, right? Right. So I said, well, I was a teacher for 6 years, but 3 of them were spent in one of the worst fucking neighborhoods, and, mm-hmm. which is, I'll say it, it was Webster.
Dangerous Minds.
it was Webster Avenue and 182nd Street in the Bronx, which mm-hmm. is about 6 blocks south of Fordham University.
Wow.
For those who don't know That's New York City, it's called Murder Hill. Yeah. But for those who are not familiar with New York City or the Bronx specifically, it would be that the West Coast analog would be USC, 1992, 6 blocks
Ooh-wee.
South. It is literally,
right.
literally that.
Right.
And I'm not fucking around when mm-hmm. I say it is literally that. Even mm-hmm. now, I run into
it's
my
right
students.
In the middle of the hood.
Yes, Fordham campus. University,
well, Fordham.
6 blocks north yeah. of one of literally the legislatively worst neighborhoods on the fucking planet. And I taught at the school, middle school 391. Yeah. I run into my students every now and then from then, and they just like, dude, it's never gotten better. You know, it's just a different
It's a real life lean on me,
worse.
Right?
Yeah, it is.
Worse.
Right.
It's kind of gotten worse.
It has.
To a certain degree.
Right. So I write this And so, and I spent, good God, dude, I spent 45 days mm-hmm. on that first draft. Right. And I mean, and I don't mean 45 days of 5 day weeks. I mean, 45 straight motherfucking days right. of pouring my heart and soul and also coming up with something a little bit different. Because mm-hmm. I was like, people have seen Lean On Me, right. people have seen Dangerous Minds, but I added a musical aspect.
Okay. Right.
So basically, my script is called Learning Curve. Mm-hmm. And it's a story of a disgraced rapper who returns to the neighborhood he left only to realize that the music that he created only helped to make things worse. Oh. So he's seeking redemption because he had this whole horrible thing happen in L.A. So he had to leave L.A., right. goes back to his old neighborhood. But it turns out that back in the day, he was the guy who produced his demo. It's like kind of like the Suge Knight of New York.
Right, right.
And he's like, well, you're back. And you never really made restitution for all the stuff. So now he's being attacked on two fronts, one in the Department of Education and one on the street.
Yeah.
So it's basically, I pitch it as a cross between Empire and Boston Public.
Okay.
So that's what I wrote.
Okay.
I put all kind of really cool musical numbers in it. Not because I was doing, I just felt like this would be fucking cool because.
Sounds interesting to me. Right. Sounds current.
So I give it to my reps and they were just like, yeah, no, this is not going to work. And there was a sticking point in it. And I'll tell you the sticking point because this is part of the story. And I want any screenwriter to know this, that one of my students, and this is real, was molested by her boyfriend. Her mother's boyfriend.
Right.
And the reason why he was able to molest his child and get away with it, because she was in a house full of brothers and sisters, is because her mother would take her SNAP or food stamps, because it's on a card now, and would trade drugs or whatever for the food stamps.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So these kids weren't eating. The older daughters and brothers would just hustle on their own, but the little girl, she was starving. Mm. So the mother's boyfriend was like, I'll get you food if you do whatever.
Okay.
That's what happened. It blew up in my face in the classroom because this young lady was always a horrible student, was just unkempt, smelled bad, was always doing bad things. And I didn't know what was wrong with her. And then one day
she was reacting.
See, that's the thing. Right. I didn't know. Right. I was so naive, and idealistic, you know, which is my greatest strength and weakness, I guess. Mm. Because I still try to believe people are good, but it kicks me in the ass when I realize they're not sometimes, you know? So I will never forget this day, the rest of my life, when she was freaking out. They called school security, and those of us who have ever spent time in New York know that school security is NYPD, right? So they try to subdue her peaceably because, you know, even though you hear these stories about, you know, people locking up black kids, you know, generally speaking, people really do try to calm the situation down.
Yeah.
No one wants to put a kid in there. No, nobody really wants to put kids in handcuffs. No. I'm as someone who actually was in the front lines of this, she just wouldn't sit down. She gets up, then she like, bam, elbows the police officer. So when you do that, no matter who you are, they're going to. I still feel it.
Yeah.
They step out. So the point is that they took her down. Mm-hmm. And they were like, please calm down. And she unleashed a wail of pain and grief that is still echoing in my ears to this day. And I put that scene in the script, right?
Damn.
Wow. Only to have my former reps tell me that an executive wouldn't go for it.
What?
Because of that scene. Because I have a scene where the mother says flat out, I don't give a shit about you because you're just like your brother who's in Rikers. Wow. So I don't really care. Because this actually happened in front of me as a human being. And this is where my whole naive idealism kicked in. And I was sitting there watching this. And this is I'm going back to, this was 2005 or 2004 or so.
Right.
And it really hurt me. And I felt like that story, that moment needs to be encapsulated and dramatized. So I put in, this would, according to my reps, former reps, this would put me in the right position now because I would do something dark.
It's edgy, yes.
And it's real, and it's dealing with the experience of African-American youth in inner cities, particularly in the Bronx.
Right.
And they just kept telling me it wouldn't work. So then I listened to them because I had trusted them.
Right.
And then I did a page one rewrite of the goddamn outline. And I hate writing outlines, but I did it. So I handed in an outline. Mm-hmm. They didn't like it. Write another outline. I'm like, okay, I wrote another outline. They didn't like that one.
Wow.
So I wrote a third outline, and they didn't like that. And I'm just like, okay. So then I had posted a YouTube thing. This takes us up to 2017.
Okay.
So here we go.
Tell again.
I wrote this in February 2017. Then I get to, so staffing season 2017 comes and goes. And because I spent probably 90 days working on this one thing, I missed the window. So they went out with my old specs, which were great, but people had already seen them.
Right.
So then I get a call one day saying, So I put a YouTube video up saying, okay, if you're a writer, this is how you manage disappointment. I wasn't blaming anyone. I was just saying, if you're a writer, and you could be writing prose, screenplays, comics, this is how you manage your disappointment and keep moving forward. To some, that was interpreted as me complaining. Even though if you look at it, it's completely not that. So literally the day after I published, I put that video up, my former management dropped me.
Really?
Yeah. I don't know if it was connected, but it sure felt awfully coincidental. So after that, I felt like complete shit from that day up until the day I submitted that to the WGA TV Access Writer Project. And that
now,
was what October.
Can I ask you a question?
Absolutely.
Did you go back to your original one? Version?
Oh, no, yeah, yeah. That's what I submitted. Okay. That was the one, because I had written...
You said fuck all their stuff.
Yeah, I said, you know what? Let me just see
if
it was me or if it was someone else. Because I've heard stories for years, and I never fucking believed them, I'm being honest, where a writer, a successful writer, will be like, yeah, this movie which made $275 million, this is the same script, and my agents hated it.
Well, let me just say this.
You know, and I didn't believe it.
I have interviewed...
I didn't believe it.
Damn near 200 people on this show.
Right.
And on other shows and in other situations. Every single person, we talk about this all the time, every single person who... finally crossed over. Like the guy who wrote I, Tonya.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And did a whole bunch of shit before. Right. He was almost done and decided to write. And all of his agents were like, no, not that one.
Tonya Harding?
I'm telling you, it's always the one. Chris has one right now that people told him he shouldn't write that I think is going to get him a Golden Globe.
Oh,
you know what I mean?
Okay.
So I have one that everybody told me not to write that I think will do the same thing. Right. So you just never, it's the one because it's coming from here.
This is the thing about the managers and the agents is that... You know, I haven't had one in a very long time for could be a lot of reasons, but I spent a lot of time thinking about it. I spent a lot of time I've had three different managers and two different agents, and I've thought about what, you know, like where are the mistakes? Like you were saying before, is a lot of stuff that you did wrong. You did wrong. You think that you did wrong. And then you hear from people, they tell you, you get all this piecemeal information that kind of like fills in the question that you've been asking. And what it is that, you know, they like to be around creative people.
Mm-hmm.
They like to be around the energy that the creative stuff gives them. And, you know, a lot of them have worked at agencies or worked at studios, stuff like that, in mailrooms to pick up. But the thing is that nobody really knows what's going to touch anybody.
Yeah. Mm.
And the thing is that agents, and particularly agents, but managers of them, like, don't give you the greatest advice because they're not really storytellers. They want to be,
right?
But they're not, because if they were storytellers, they'd be doing that.
Right.
Because it's such a hard, specific thing. And the thing that you need them for, and if they're good, they're good at this. They're good at seeing what the marketplace is aware of. And seeing what is selling and being able to, you know, and to give you guidance and to say, hey, this could work this way. Because the fact that they're telling you that, oh, there's one exec who's not going to like this, but aren't there 400 shows on the air?
Right.
There's so many different places there's new stuff popping up. You know, like, I mean, at the time when you probably showed them that, there wasn't Apple yet, right? So who knows who's going to say yes to this? Are people going to get like shuffled in? I mean, you know, there's that revolving chair of people at that level too. So you don't ever know who's going to respond to stuff that happens. And I guarantee you, the story about, you know, as you just kind of mentioned about, well, this is a script that, you know, that my managers didn't like, my agents didn't like. See, they get like deluged by so much material that they almost, and so do a lot
you
of
You think
people.
They get numb to it a little bit?
Mm. Yeah, they get numb to it.
Yeah.
They get numb to it. And it takes something really, and the thing is that, you know, like, we see a lot of bad movies.
Sure.
You know,
and television.
And, yeah, and a lot of bad TV shows.
Right.
But you got to realize I watch movies and sometimes I say, that's killing the business. That movie getting made is killing the business because it's going to be so bad and they put a lot of money in it. But the thing is that's what they thought was great.
Somebody did.
Yeah.
Somebody wrote
the
check.
And the thing is, there's stuff that's 10 times worse than that the managers have to wade through. They have to weed. They have to. See, the thing that I think, it goes back to what I was saying here before about when I told Gunn, I said, just read the first 10 pages, right? Because there's a really great what's the guy's name who wrote Cat's Cradle? Kurt Vonnegut. Mm. Okay, so Kurt Vonnegut has these 7 or 8 rules for short stories, mm-hmm. which I think are like absolutely perfect for any kind of writing. But I think the last one on his thing is respect everyone's time.
Mm.
You know that what you're giving someone, you gotta, you know what, that's their time.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're gonna abuse it by giving this something that's not good because you want it read, then you're fucking up. And that, and you know, and honestly, that might make your, you know, like your manager, your agent, or the producer, whoever, read it, like be mad for a couple of days, you know. And next thing you know, they gotta read your thing with that bad taste of that script right. in their mouth.
Mm-hmm. We've all read a script when we're not in a good mood, and you just didn't even like
right,
it.
You didn't
exactly.
feel it. Right.
And that could, and you know what? And at that point, you're arguing with them about something that to them, they might not know that that's how they read it.
Mm-hmm.
And but the worst thing is they never back down. Right. That side never backs down on a point. That's why I got fired from my last agent, because we were arguing about a project that my brother and I wanted to do. And no, there was a thing that my brother and I didn't want to do. That this guy was like, Screen Gems is going to pay for this thing, do this thing, mm-hmm. blah, blah, blah. And I was like, I don't want to do a dance movie. I don't want to do another dance. I mean, look, I can't write that thing. I did one. Right. You know, that's the first thing we sold. I don't really want to do another one. I don't want to do that. And our agent was like, you fucking better do that shit. You know, like, just put together the pitch. So, you know, we're putting together the pitch. This other movie comes out. I can't remember what it was. It might have been like Stomp the Yard or something like that.
Step Up.
And it did really, you know, and it did really, really, really well.
Mm-hmm.
And then that Monday, and the box office came out, you know, my agent called me and said, see, now write that fucking pitch so we can go in and take it to them.
Wow.
You know? So my brother and I are like, you know, fucking feeling cowed and shit.
Right.
We go and write this thing, put all this effort into it, all this kind of stuff, come back, give it to him. And the guy says, yeah, I don't want to do any dance movies for a while right now.
Hmm.
And I look at my agent, and I was like, you motherfucker.
Wow.
I said to him, I said, you motherfucker.
Hmm.
They don't want to do that shit now because they just did it. They're not going to want to do it again. It doesn't matter if it's going to be 2 years to get us out.
If anything, they're going to stick with the franchise.
Right. Yeah. Right. You know, right. And honestly, I don't think that Screen Gems has put out a dance movie since then theatrically.
Mm-hmm.
They've put him out, you know.
A VOD, right?
VOD, but not theatrically. Right. And I was looking at him like, I told him that. I said, you motherfucker, and was screaming at him on the, which maybe I shouldn't have done, but I was so mad. I was so mad because of the disrespect that he gave us two weeks before.
Right.
You know, that I was like, oh, you're going to slap me? I got to slap you back, you know. And then he was like, you know what? No, you guys have to go. We have to part ways.
Mm.
But I was kind of like, but you don't know. You don't know that they're going to want this. You know what I'm saying? And it's like, that's where it's such a tricky relationship. And it's like, you said it right now. You said you wrote 3 outlines for these guys. And to me, I'm kind of saying to myself, I heard that from a lot of people. Right. There are people who are like, write these outlines. And to me, I'm like, fuck no. I don't want to write an outline for shit. It's like, there's a way that I see this. That's, you know what? That's what I want to do. That's how I see this. Mm-hmm. If you don't see this, then you don't need to do this.
Right.
And I'll do it myself.
Right.
Later on for you.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not going to do it your way, because if you knew the pathway to the gold on the story, you would tell me.
Right.
And then I just type it up. But you want me to kind of like dig around in the dirt and find it. And you know what? That's what I did before I gave you the first outline. I dug around in the dirt and found the gold.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And then you go, that's not gold enough for me.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You know, wait, what? It's gold. It's still gold. It's still gold. You know.
And I'm always open to like.
It might be powder gold, but damn it, it's gold.
But the thing is, I was always open to notes, but I wasn't getting notes. I was getting start all over again. Right. That's not a note.
Exactly. See, and that's the whole thing. That's the thing. Like, I will welcome notes.
Mm-hmm.
And the big thing with notes is trying to figure out what their note is that they're saying.
But
if people are saying start over again, then it's kind of like they don't even know what they don't. It's like they can't articulate what they don't like.
Right.
And at that point, then it's like, then you really shouldn't be telling me anything if you can't articulate it.
I just had this conversation about a month ago with I just signed with some new reps before the beginning of the year.
Congratulations.
At the end of the year. And love my new manager. Shout out to Adriana. And But when we first started, she'd read a script and she'd be like, I need more here. I'm like, what the fuck does that mean?
Right.
And so I had to sit down with her and go, here's an example of what I need. So if you give me a note here and you say, I need more here. So I need more here when the character does this. Can you give me more of that? Or yes. Maybe when she goes to the right instead, maybe if she went to the left. So by the time we get to page 16, she does such and such and such. That's the kind of note I need. Now she gets it. So when she's going through and she gives me her notes, I'm like, yes, bitch.
See, those
yes.
are notes.
That's what I'm talking about. And there's an art to giving a note. You know what
right,
I mean?
Right.
And now we click. So it's like, I get it. We're on the same path.
I mean, to me, it's like the best notes you get are you get from people who write because right. they kind of know.
Right.
I mean, I'm not going to tell you about this. I'll tell you offline about this project that I'm doing. But the guy who's going to EP it, God willing, like the notes he gave me were so, I mean, it was very little in terms of what he, but it's so specific and it went very deep on what that was. And it allowed me to kind of to zone in so razor sharp on what the rewrite was going to be. I said, oh, it's going to be right. He's like, no, this is not a rewrite. This is just a polish.
Right.
This is the way I see it as a polish. You only got to do a few things, like four scenes you got to work on. Mm. And I was like, okay. Okay.
Right. And you can deal with that.
Yeah, I can deal with it. I mean, none of this, you got to start over.
Right.
That doesn't mean anything.
Because the thing that scared me was he sent me an email and said, I like the draft, but I haven't know what's talk. And I was saying to myself,
yeah, that's a little vague.
And I was trying to like, outthink him before I got on the call. Why are you waiting to say? I was like, oh, what did he not like? What did he not like?
Right.
What is this? And it was like so easy because he knew specifically.
Yeah, he just wanted to explain it to you.
Yes, explain it to me. Yeah, and I'm just kind of like, that's where I mean, I understand that managers and agents, their time is limited during the
day,
and they perhaps don't have time, and then sometimes they might need to get their assistants to kind of like to dictate the notes, stuff like that. That's all fine.
Mm-hmm.
That's all really really fine. But I'm kind of like, have the courtesy to give me that attention and that focus at that moment,
right?
Because otherwise, if I got to write three additional outlines, I might have to walk away from you because that's making me mad. Mm-hmm. That's making me real mad because I could be working on that's three other projects I could have been developing.
Right.
You know? So
and to me, that's because you don't have the ability to tell me how to steer it within what I wrote.
Mm.
You know what I mean? You should be able you're a fucking manager and agent. You should have read hundreds of scripts by now. You should understand structure and character and all that other stuff. You should be able to read my story and go, oh.
Bam, 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 bam.
I see. Right. So you focused on the male character, but the female character is actually a lot more interesting.
Hmm.
So I think you should do a page one, and here's why. What if you focused on the female so she became the killer and yada, 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 and then you'd be like, oh, you see what I mean? Now you at least have reason. And why? I'm just spitballing here.
Yeah.
But as opposed to just going, this is just, I don't know what to do with this. This isn't.
I can't sell
this
it.
This doesn't connect to me.
Right.
You can sell anything. Because I've seen shit that shouldn't have been sold.
Right.
And it did.
Correct. And so to me, they have to learn the art on how to do that. Like, just like we do. Whenever we hear a story, we know immediately how to turn it into a movie or into a TV show. Immediately.
Right.
You should know exactly how to do that with a note, in my opinion. You know what I mean? So, yeah, that's good.
Yeah,
that's good.
So yeah, but I'm happy now. Things are much better, and I'm taking one day at a time, and just living life. I mean, I went away for 3 weeks at the end of December, all the way up through early January, and going back to the East Coast was an emotional healing process because I think the other problem was I didn't leave LA at all last year.
Oh, okay, and you never got out.
No, I never got out. I was in this for 357 days.
Right.
Pretty much. And being in a place where you're constantly insecure, you're constantly feeling like you suck, and no one is telling you otherwise, it starts to erode on you. And then when I got out of here, because in the past, I would leave, generally speaking, I'm happy when I leave LA four times a year. Like once every 3 months, going someplace.
Right.
That's not a desert. Because
you haven't been anywhere in a while, have you?
Yeah.
You need to get away somewhere.
Yeah. That's not a desert.
Yes.
And when I went back to East Coast, I went and it was freezing and it was a horrible, I was stuck at JFK Airport and all that stuff. But you know what? I was
but
able to weather
thinking
that
about
storm.
The bullshit.
No, it was funny because on Facebook, around right before New Year's, I had not thought about the industry in almost 2 weeks.
Wow.
At that point, I had not thought about.
So you didn't do no work. You just cut
off.
No,
I just
sometimes
got the
you
fuck
need to
out.
Do it.
I got out of here, and I let's see. What did I do? I watched Impractical Jokers all day on True TV. I watched I played a lot of video games, and I did watch a lot of YouTube, you know, true crime things. That's all I did. And I felt like I saw my people in Baltimore. I saw my people in New York, and I just felt like a human being again. So when I hit the ground in 2018 back here, I was so much better. And I'm still riding that crest of really not giving a fuck anymore and just getting – because I've come up with – I should have three samples new going out, including the teacher one, which has been resurrected going out for staffing season this time. So, you know, I've done everything I could do, and I don't, I guess I can't control people's, you know, expectations or insecurities or fears. I just want a fair shot.
Right.
And I don't want to be, I don't want it to be a negative that I'm not a moron. I don't want it to be negative that I'm confident. And I don't want to be a negative that I don't tolerate disrespect. That's not a negative.
I don't think it's negative at all.
But it's, but that's how it's been given back to me, that all these things that are just, I think, standard in humanity, I think sometimes in black men are seen as negatives.
Well, but,
you know.
Look, I totally agree with you on that, because it's like one of the things that I can tell just from like reading some of your Facebook stuff and talking with you more now and the other time. It's kind of like you are like a very well-read person. And one of the things that I've noticed a lot is that sometimes that can be looked at as a negative.
Yeah, clearly.
If you're black. And I don't know why. You know, for in terms of if you're on other black people, that's what I mean. If you're like it will impress white people because they either aren't that well-read themselves or don't expect and therefore they think, well, if I'm not well-read, then these black people just are you know, are scratching the surface with Dr. Seuss only type of shit, you know? So I kind of feel like that's what can impress people. But the thing is that it's one of the things I was saying earlier about like who do you want to like meet and things like that. And I think our natural inclination is who are the black showrunners who can hire us, who are these people who can hire us, stuff like that. And it's harder for us to say who are the white people that can hire us. But I kind of feel like that's kind of where we have to kind of push in a sense, particularly you and me, because we write genre, you know? And it's like, well, that obviously, like that right there puts you in like a very, very small space for black writers are doing, you know, this is sad, you know, particularly after last weekend.
Right. Well, let's get it.
Because we see some dope ass shit that you know, that should have been.
And a hunger for it.
Yes. Well, see, you know what? This is the thing. It's 360 or 380.
361 was where I was at last night at some point. So I'm sure it's up now.
And they say it's the number one opening
ever
in February ever. It's already like in one of the top five domestic openings,
right? Already.
So to me, I'm saying to myself, and I've been saying this since last November. This movie will probably be the last major blockbuster.
You don't think Wrinkle in Time is going to get him? I wonder if it's going to be this big, because it's almost a different audience to some extent.
It's a different audience. I don't know if it'll be as big. Right. I mean, but I think this movie being a Marvel movie like brings in a different type of people.
Okay. I see where you're going.
I believe that Black Panther is definitely going to be the box office champ of this year. But I don't know. I mean, and depending on what it tops out at, I don't know what is like potentially like could top it, because there's been such a thirst for this type of movie. For this type of characterization, this type of display presentation that we've never seen. Right. The thing about Wrinkle in Time is Wrinkle in Time still feels like a Harry Potter like film. I'm not saying that in a bad way.
But I'm saying
I know what you're saying.
But I'm saying, well, I've seen that kind of world before.
Right.
You know, it's the girl's got to come and save and the kid and blah, and it's all featured out. And it looks great, you know, and hats off to Ava getting ready to do this movie.
Definitely.
But I'm kind of like, it's a different thing to do the Afrofuturism and to do it the way they did it in Black Panther. I mean, that's just my thoughts. You know, I could be wrong. But I don't know.
I mean, I hope it's going to be a huge. I think it's going to be huge.
Oh, it's going to be. It's huge.
I mean, it's definitely. I think it's going to do $100 million in the first weekend.
Yes.
Just because I know I'm gonna go, but I know that the black girl nerds and them, they're just going to be killing. you know, everybody on Twitter to go out and see it. People are already talking about what they're wearing. Mm-hmm. You know, they doing the same type of thing, mm-hmm. you know, with Black Panther.
Right.
But I think you're right on the money. Black Panther speaks to a Marvel, so Marvel's already has that up under their umbrella, and everybody's familiar with that. You know, as
it's a preheated
to,
oven.
Like, some people haven't read the book.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
But that's what I'm saying. See, I think that the Black Panther still also speaks to Black men in a way that the other film won't be doing.
Right.
And also that just films in general don't do.
Right.
And to me, I was thinking about this when we were coming up here. I was like, as cool as Black Panther is, as great as it is, in terms of what it did is, it kind of like set the stage for something where other people kind of missed the boat and they could have done this.
Right.
And like, it's because it's timing, right? It's timing. Like, it's like, I was saying all along, if you had Chiwetel Ejiofor
mm-hmm.
play K mm-hmm. in the Blade Runner sequel.
That's right.
Damn, that would have been dope.
Because because here, it's coming out earlier than Black Panther.
Mm-hmm.
It would have done, and then this audience base that you know was dying for something like this, they would have came out to that movie.
Right.
And they didn't. Because mm-hmm. they're like, we're not represented in this
again.
Movie.
Right. Right,
and I love Blade Runner 2049, but they could have used I don't understand why they, but I do understand. But man,
but no, but
it would have been nice.
But imagine Chiwetel in that role.
Right. No, I can.
I'm saying you'd be like, shit, I've seen this movie twice. Right. I've seen it twice mm-hmm. because it would have been a different movie on so many levels.
Oh man, it wouldn't have been. Oh my God, that would have been dope. Jesus. All right. It's all hitting me now. I'm like, wow. I remember him in Serenity.
Yeah.
Right. How awesome he was in that little bit of role.
Yeah.
So, he's a scene stealer.
Right. Stealer. And I'm saying to myself, that's where I think Black Panther touches on things that the audience has just been like dying for since like the 74 Shaft or whatever it was. Like they haven't seen, we've seen other movies and stuff like this, like people getting their due. I mean, the previous Shaft that came out with Sam Jackson, but this is like a different thing, you know, and it kind of, and there's so many.
Hyper-idealized.
Yeah. And it's the thing that
which we needed, Jesus.
Yeah, and it's the thing that I've been saying all along, the thing about Get Out is that the thing that makes Get Out great is a great movie, and I've seen this for like 10 or 15 years. That's an elevated genre film,
mm-hmm.
and an elevated genre film,
psychological.
Yeah. If that, you know, like type of movie with a black lead or something like that, really, really like does a lot
mm-hmm.
because there's always that, you know, cause you can go back to that Eddie Murphy he did in Delirious when he was, or was it Raw? And he was like, you know, if black people show up in the haunted house, they're like, out. You know,
yeah, right.
Get out. Yeah, and
it's time to go.
And I kind of feel like there's that. I think that black people don't necessarily go see a lot of those elevated genre films for that reason because they're like, motherfucker, I'd be gone in 5 seconds, you know.
Yeah.
But
Get Out. We live every day.
But Get Out every day.
Yeah,
and guess what?
That's real.
He couldn't leave because he was in the second place. And you're like, oh, shit. So I kind of feel like he touched on something that is like, that's how you can make those movies, like, just sing in a way and make the money that you want them to make that they're not doing, you know? It's too bad.
Well, it's funny because a group of us went and saw it on Sunday, right? And so afterward, we went to go to Coffee Bean just to talk about it and decompress. And so one of our friends said, well, I was wondering, do you think Michael B. would be a better Black Panther? And we all went we're like, no way. Mm. Now, here's the deal. This is just interesting, though. Now, one of us was my producing partner, Pamela, who's a big casting director. So she was looking at it from a casting point. My friend who said it is a really big DP, so he was looking at it from his point of
lighting
view as a film.
Right.
You know, all that other. Right. Now, we had some issues with the lighting at the beginning, by the way. Did you know that whole first opening scene? It was like, where is everybody?
Mm.
You can't hardly see shit. You hear fighting. You hear poof, 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 but you can't see shit. Anyway, so we were talking about the whole casting thing. Mm-hmm. And I was like, no, Michael B., wonderful actor. He would be a totally different Black Panther.
Mm.
Black Panther is an educated prince. He's super smart. He has to think.
And subdued.
Right. And if you see Michael B. and his swag, and his motherfucker
he's
walking
crackling.
Like he just came out
he's
of Oakland.
Right.
You know what I mean? Which his character did.
Yeah.
But you know what I mean? No.
Right.
No. He looked beautiful, and the fucking body was amazing. all that, but it's a different character.
Well, yeah, because I'm not, I mean, like, I'd be curious to see Michael B. play a restrained character.
Right.
I've never seen him do that in his work. Right. You know, I'm not saying he can't.
No, 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 no.
But I'd be curious to see him do that because that's where, you know, because I think we're processing it off of what we've seen them do. And so Chadwick, we've seen him play Jackie Robinson right. with mm-hmm. this type
right.
of dignity.
Right. Thurgood Marshall.
Right. Thurgood Marshall with this type of like mm-hmm. gravitas that mm-hmm. it's all these kind of things that
was that him and James Brown?
And James Brown.
Oh my God, that was yeah. right. Jesus.
Yeah. So there's just so
the boy can switch.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And I just think with Michael B, you know, for whatever it is, you know, I mean he's great actor. Fantastic actor, but he hasn't had the same type of movie roles like experience yet.
Right.
And I kind of think that, you know, and also because he's young, you know what I mean? He's, mm-hmm. he's not 40, mm-hmm. you know? So, and I say that not like it's a bad thing, but I'm just kind of like, if he had another 10 years in the game, then he'd have a whole bunch of different movies just to right. compare him about. Right. I just kind of feel like that's where, and Michael plays the young guy with the type of energy that you want to have. I mean, he was such a good casting in that movie. Like just the way he would kind of do things mm-hmm. and just kind of like, I mean, there's that small line that he gives to the girl when he's like, to the woman in the museum, when mm-hmm. he's like, he was like, do you think your ancestors, you know, like paid a fair price for this? You know, exactly. I was like, oh, shit. He just was so perfect for that. So, but you're right. It's different. Mm-hmm. It's different. Mm-hmm. If he's Black Panther. I don't know who else who could be.
Well, I saw on Twitter last night somebody was chiming in about how somebody said this great little tweet about how nice it is to see, you know, the black blah blah blah, and of course, you know, a lot of white people
chiming in. Yeah.
And somebody said, well, you know, it would have been better to just see like Idris Elba or something like that. I was like, as Black Panther, and I was like,
he's too old.
He could be his father.
He's too old,
but he's yeah. too
way too old.
Way yeah. too clearly, you don't know the comic.
Yeah. A lot of people don't. That's you know the trick.
What I'm saying? Yeah, exactly,
right,
exactly.
Right.
But see, the problem is, and we were talking about this too, Chadwick was perfect as Black Panther.
Mm-hmm.
Number one, we don't have 900 choices. There could have been 500 white dudes who could have played if it was a white character in that age range. Mm-hmm. We have like five dudes, maybe.
Right.
You know what I mean? Who can hold a movie and mm-hmm. get people in there and get financing and distribution and all that shit like that. He's at the top of the list.
Right.
Actually, absolutely. Probably more so than Michael. Mm-hmm. You feel me?
In the short term, yeah.
Right,
absolutely.
Right. Because
true.
He's had more,
yeah,
more shit to do.
And Marvel set him right. up a very specific way.
Right. He's been in the other movies, et cetera, exactly. et cetera. So, yeah. Yeah. Right. yeah. So that in itself makes the most sense for why. Because a lot of people don't understand why people cast. You know, it's got a whole different reasoning behind who and why. And we were talking about this also. We're in the middle of casting my Black Wall Street movie, right?
So, Oklahoma, right?
Yeah,
Tulsa.
Right. So we have it out to a big actor right now. His agents are supposed to be having a lunch with the casting director. And so we were talking about why we sent the letters to the producers on why we wanted this particular person over who they thought they wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And it was this long like monologue explaining all the intersections between distribution and all these other things and how they're right on the cusp of once they finish this thing, by the time we come out, we'll be here. You see what I mean? Mm-hmm. So there was a lot of adding things up and how much money they save us because of it's math.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not always, oh, but they look exactly like the real Black Panther in the comic book. It's like, yeah, but there's math to this thing. You mm-hmm. know what I mean?
So, the business side of it.
Well, see, right. there's that, but I think you made a good point about how you got to be able to like hold the movie. I think a lot of people don't realize that. I remember a friend of mine, he was in, he had a little small role in, Is it Charlie's Angels 2 that had Bruce Willis had the little comic, the cameo probably. Or something like that? I can't remember which one it was, but he was in a scene with Bruce Willis one time in a movie, and he was like Bruce Willis, although he's not that tall,
yeah,
he has he projects this presence
right.
that you know why he is the lead of movies,
right.
And it's not just. You know, there's a lot to that because mm-hmm. you look at Black Panther. It's like, you know, Chadwick Boseman. He's in almost. He's controlling the drama in every mm-hmm. scene.
Right.
That's a lot to put on an actor because mm-hmm. you see people who can't do it.
Right.
You know.
Right. That's an important thing to look at. People just think, oh, because he or she is a hot actor and actress that they should be able to do the role. But there's lots more. It's about carrying a movie. Like, for instance, we're in the middle of trying to raise money for this pilot we're going to go shoot independently. Mm. And the two leads are huge internet stars who do these skits. So they can act, but nobody's seen them do a whole half-hour show. And our show is like a Dark Atlanta type of show, right?
Oh, wow.
And so so we need to shoot it because we have to show the proof of concept in order to get the network to buy it anyway.
Mm-hmm.
We can't just sell it to the network. They're going to want to cast some other people.
Right.
Yeah. You know what I mean? So we have to show them that they can handle 30 minutes. Mm. You know what I mean? Or 24 minutes, whatever the fuck.
Right.
So sometimes you have to do that to prove the point, you know, to prove the concept, which is right. why they came up with proof of concepts in the first place. Also, and this is what I was going to tell you earlier, is mm-hmm. a lot of people who get on staff and on TV shows, they get stuck in waiting for Hollywood.
Right.
So whenever people ask you about you doing your comic books, it's like, I'm not waiting.
Right.
I still have other things to do.
Absolutely.
Because they still right. steer you in other ways. They still allow you to write animation shows. They still allow you to do whatever. So had you not have been doing that, you wouldn't be able to get those, right?
See, to me, that's kind of a bullshit line because the people don't care that you write comic books.
Mm.
Because I don't know the real reasoning behind, but I've heard stories about why Brian Michael Bendis left Marvel.
Hmm.
I heard that the people at DC want to give him more control on the movie stuff.
I believe that.
That's primarily based upon his comic writing.
Right. Yeah.
You know?
Well, see, okay, and I'm glad you brought that up because in a lot of ways, people like Bendis and even Geoff Johns, and there's no disrespect because I love all their work, but they get the opportunity.
Right.
And that's what it all comes down to, is that somebody someplace somewhere made a decision that Bendis would be allowed to write stuff at Marvel. And sadly, we all, as people of color, don't always get that. And if you are a black writer at Marvel or DC, you need to be a Pulitzer Prize winner or a National Book Award mm-hmm. winner or somebody who on New York Times bestseller list like Roxane Gay or Nnedi Okorafor or Ta-Nehisi Coates. Right. You know, whereas Marvel and DC are populated with white writers who have not done anything
but comics.
Close. And I mean, a lot. There's a couple of guys, I'm not going to name them, who just walked into Marvel and got big books.
Yeah.
And I think that's the disparity, at least in the comic book side, that has to be addressed. Mm-hmm. But I mean, I
was going somewhere with this, though.
Okay, go ahead.
And I think didn't you shoot something recently?
Yeah, I shot a short UFO thriller.
Right.
Yeah.
So where I'm going with that is, those are the things you have to do. That's the right. thing you're in control of.
Right.
That's saying, I'm not waiting for Hollywood. Like we always do, we just go and shoot our shit.
Mm-hmm.
Just go and shoot the concept, whatever it is. You know how to do it. You know how to direct. You know how to produce. You know what I mean? So why not put on that hat and make the work? Show them. They don't have time to read something. Show them something.
I agree.
And that's what I'm saying is, instead, we get on a show, and then you get off 20 weeks later, and you never fucking work for 5 years, right? That, to me, no offense to anybody, that's kind of your fault.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're not taking initiative of all the things you've learned and went, wait a minute, I could put together $2,000 or $3,000 and go shoot a little something, whatever the fuck, you know what I mean?
Right.
And make it look like it's 20, right. You know what I mean? And to me, that's the next step. People aren't taking the next step. They're just sitting back.
Right.
Well, I guess I got to write another script. And like, or you could go shoot
something. Right.
Something to show grow.
Or put something out. I mean, like, you know, what's his name? Who I always want to get on this show, but he's busy. Leonard Chang, right?
Right.
So I first met him. I think he
listened to the show.
Yeah. That's why I'm saying his name right now because I'm just gonna listen.
Hey, Leonard, what's up, man? Come on the show, Jack.
I guess they're doing a Snowfall right now, so yeah. I know he's busy doing that. But
you know, I want to write on the show. Holla at a brother. Yeah, I got five scripts for you right now.
I met him maybe 5 or 6 years ago at a panel, and he was. And he came out of one of those programs, can't remember, and he couldn't get staffed.
Mm-hmm.
But
really?
But he was writing novels. Is how he kind of he'd been writing novels before he got into this, and so he went back and wrote some more novels. You know, and they're not like bestsellers and everything like that, but you know, they're crime stuff, so it's harder to break through. They're all very, very massively told because I've read like two of them. I'm just like, he's a great fucking writer, and he's like, he's not waiting for Hollywood, you know. And then something happened where he got on this show that I really, really loved. I can't remember what it was called now, but it was with this guy who lived in a world where he was in a car accident and it split his reality.
Oh, it's Jason Isaacs.
Jason Isaacs.
I know what you're talking about. He wakes up in one world. His wife is dead, I know what you're talking about.
His kid is dead in the other,
You don't know which one is the real one.
Yeah, yeah. And show.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
That should have been on NBC. It should have been a cable show. Right. But he got that, and then that was short-lived, you know, and it was gone.
I like that show.
It was a good show. Very good show. And then he was able to, you know, I think he put a book out right after that. And then he got on Justified. And it, you know, and basically he hasn't stopped working since Justified because he wasn't waiting. He was like, I'm just going to, you know, because, and then I was talking to him one time and I was like, well, what's it like? And he was like, well, look, people like the fact that I'm a novelist because they know that I can put the whole story together.
Right.
You know, and I think that's the same thing with your comics. It's like, you can put the whole story together. There's not a room for me to develop. I got to develop the story.
Right.
So we're on for like 5 issues or a whole graphic novel. It's just me.
Right.
So if you, like you said earlier about, you know, like I can build the world. I can create these little backstories you need for Agent Carter because I am used to doing everything. I'm not saying it like it's a brag. Some people might say it's a brag. Perhaps they might look at it as a brag, but it's like, you know what? That's what I have to do to survive, to get in this position. Yeah. I got to do everything, you know?
But see, to me, that's not a brag at all. When you go on your showrunner meeting, you're supposed to be going there and then to tell them what your superpower is.
Yeah.
And sometimes your superpower is, I'm the guy who can write, you know, all the bios or whatever the fuck it is, whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? I'm the dude, so you don't have to do it. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? I'm the guy who could do it and I'll turn it in like 2 hours, whatever the fuck. You know what I mean? You have to sell that thing to make them go, shit, we need him.
Right.
Somebody else just came in who was already genre like you. Mm-hmm. So let me show them your superpowers. You know what I mean? So I think that's not being arrogant. Mm-hmm. That's saying, here's how I help you.
Right.
You know what I mean?
I agree with that.
Right.
Yeah.
Where you get stuck. This is where, and let's talk about this briefly.
Sure.
This is where writers need to be, I think, careful. Now, you guys know who my mentor is. And he used to tell me all the time when Twitter came out and Facebook and all that, he's like, be very careful what you put out there. People will interpret what they want. So if you guys always see, this is just my opinion, what I learned from this person, they said, be very careful what you put out. So if people are talking politics, don't chime in. If people are talking about black this and Trump this, don't chime in. You can have the thought, you can have your group little meetings and all that stuff, but if you're the guy doing that and you want to be on a certain show and the show doesn't believe in that, they read all that. Because every time I staff a show, I'm looking at who's on there. I go on their Twitter. I go on their Facebook. I'm trying to see what kind of people they are. I'm trying to see if they're very negative. I'm trying to see if they are the because if they can just blurt out this about Trump or this about, you know, whatever the situation is, they'll do that in the room. So all I can say is, now you say that, and then you have 900 other big writers who are constantly going in about, but they're already there. You know what I mean? Like I look at my girl LaToya Morgan, she'd be going in. You know what I mean? She's there.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But when you're trying to get there, you want to play neutral, in my opinion. That's why you'd see I'm not a big Twitter head, because I don't want to be the dude who's chiming in about every negative stuff.
Right.
Even though I may believe it, you know? I'm not the first person to go, yep, he did such and such. Can you believe whatever? I might be thinking, but I'm like, they're not going to see that in my Twitter feed that I even liked it.
Yeah, I was told that about 2 years ago.
You know, it's just, and so you have to be careful with, say you get on the show and they get canceled. If you're out there going, you know, I don't understand why I'm not being hired again. I've been doing this and I've been doing that. Then you might come across as self-entitled.
Right.
So
which I never did, though.
But I'm generalizing.
Yeah, I know what you're saying, though.
I was about to go down a list of things.
Yeah, right.
So I'm trying to tell you there's different ways that people interpret negatively.
Right.
To you, I was saying this. Right. To them, it was an exclamation point. Or an accusation. So you have to be, you have to decide, and I can't tell you what to do, you know, in any kind of, like our friend Paul. You know, and Jeff, they go on ranting, like, you know, Jeff, they go on ranting their butts off about anything. They don't give a fuck, but they're there. You feel me? Get there, then talk your shit. Okay, right. You know what I mean? On your way there, be like, mm-hmm, I heard it too. You know what I mean? As neutral as possible. Now, some people may enjoy that, and you might get hell of reactions back and hell of conversations back, and that may be what gets you in the door. Somebody might like that. So what I might be saying might be against everything you believe.
But at the same time, you know, it's like there are times that I say something about Trump
right.
on Twitter because it's like it's too hard for me not to.
That's fine.
Because I feel like the country is really taking a hit.
Right.
But there's so much you could say. Mm. Like, I think the big thing is that.
But you talk about a lot of other things. If that's your main thing, like all the time.
All day long.
I'm just like, I'm not even following this person anymore. Right. Like, that's, you know what I mean?
Well, yeah. Well, that's right. Not me. But I'm saying it's like, are you a loose cannon?
Right.
That's right.
What, see, that's the fear.
Right.
Because then it's like, are you going to be on the show and like explain a storyline before it happens? I mean, there's all this kind of stuff that they're afraid of. Mm-hmm. I don't know. It's an interesting thing. I mean, and you do have to be, but it's like that with everything. It's like you have to be bulletproof. You have to be bulletproof.
You have to be bulletproof to be in this industry in any whatever department you're
in. Well, you have to be bulletproof until you're vibranium, and that's when you made your money. Once you're vibranium, you're like, what's up?
That's what's up. That was that.
No, you're right. Episode. I mean, you're absolutely correct, though, because a couple years ago, I was told by a showrunner, black male, actually, good guy, and he was just like, yeah, you know, just be careful what you say on social media,
right.
You know, because people will, like you say, interpret everything negatively depending right. on the, like you could just post, hey, it's a beautiful day. And someone's like, well, what does he mean by that? You know, right. why is it beautiful? You know, right. somebody, because there's always going to be someone who has that seed of negativity and right. is looking for some, for fertile soil mm-hmm. to develop. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's definitely true.
Believe me, because I have the show and people right. will chime in and be like, well, you know, I disagree with what you guys said today on the episode. And I'd be like, mm-hmm. hey, man. Great. You, right. Hey, I appreciate you listening. I keep it like that. I don't even talk about right. what they talked about.
And I tell you, you know, I mean, you know? Black Panther to me has just been, you know, it's just a watershed of positivity.
Right.
You know, I posted on Facebook right before I left, felt like going to the Million Man March.
Right.
You know, because and the situation is very similar because in 1995, this is after the crime bill went through.
Right.
I was in college, and I remember, and I'm not saying police didn't do bad stuff before the crime bill, but once that crime bill went through in 94, 95, man, I felt like that was a turning point where right. cops was like, yeah, now.
Right. Now we got our tenure. Right.
So, you know, that was the year of OJ. That was the year of right. so many horrible things for black folk, but particularly African-American men. And going to Black Panther, when I got off the bus in D.C., you know, in back in October 95, I'll never forget that day. And I felt like when I got to the ArcLight Hollywood, mm-hmm. it was very. So I parked my car, I got out, walked,
and then my black people everywhere.
And it was just like this energy of positive. Because the ArcLight Hollywood, you never know what you're going to get. It's a mixed bag in terms of the crowd.
Right.
But that day.
And
it was
all
just,
of the things said Black Panther.
Yeah, the entire marquee, electronic marquee read Black Panther. And that was astounding to me.
Wow.
And as someone who's read comics pretty much since 1981 or 82, as someone who is a black person that creates sci-fi.
That's about when I started too.
Yeah, that creates sci-fi but with black folk in it and centralized in it. It was just an amazing moment. And it just made me feel so much better. I mean, in a lot of ways, and this is something that also, and one thing I didn't say, what helped me get through the end of 2017 was seeing Hamilton.
Mm.
And I mean this, like Hamilton was that thing that I got at the moment that I absolutely needed it.
Right.
Because.
Did you see it in New York? I saw it
at the Pantages. Okay. I wish I had seen it with the original cast, but I was out here.
Right.
But the beauty of it was.
Oh, it is still good here. Shit.
Oh, yeah, no, it was. That was a hell of a cast.
You see it with the black dude who played Hamilton? Or which one?
Okay. The black dude, the short dude.
Amazing.
And then the lady who played Eliza, Sophia she was absolutely astounding, you know. But what I was going to say was that I walked out of Hamilton, and I don't mean this in a negative sense, but I felt stupider than I've ever felt in a long time, in the sense that I watched something of utter, complete brilliance, and I was like, shit, I got to step up my game.
Right.
Walking out of Hamilton, I was like, I feel so fucking stupid. Because Lin-Manuel Miranda, goddamn, dude.
Right.
And I was just like, shit. But what that did for me in a positive sense was like, you know what, I can get to this. Mm-hmm. I can get to it. I can achieve and surpass it if I really want to.
Right.
I just got to stop and think. And what LA had did to me in 2017 was not allow me to stop and think.
2017 was a fuck.
And then even beyond just the administration, I mean, just I felt like there was a weirdness in LA. In the country in general, things were just strange.
Well, because of the election.
That was part of it, though.
It was a huge.
You know,
I think it started there.
Yeah, right.
No, but I'm saying the
it set the precedent.
The election was this, it gave birth to something that I don't think we were expecting in a lot of ways. I mean,
hate. So much hate.
Yeah, and I mean.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you about Hamilton. It's one of it's that famous quote about genius and talent. You know, it's like the talent is can hit what you know, which you know, like no one else can do, but the genius can hit you know, like what no one else can see.
Right.
And I feel like that's
great quote.
Like
that's a great quote.
Yeah, and I was just kind of like that's what Hamilton was because
yeah.
I'm sure you, being a history teacher, like know the Hamilton story.
Yeah, I mean, it was blowing my mind.
I mean, to me,
to see it done in hip-hop.
And to see these black faces and Latinos.
You know, but to me, like I was always interested in Hamilton as the historical figure because I knew he was I knew he wasn't white. I knew he was a mixed person, and so he was always so he always felt interest to me as one of the founding fathers that I kind of gravitated with you know toward more. But the way that they portrayed it, it was just like, oh shit, man!
Right.
You like, I didn't know you could tell the story this way,
right?
And that's
my point. That when you hit a point where you see a story that you completely understand the story, but then it hits you on a level that you don't even realize. It's like this subconscious, almost Neanderthal, Cro-Magnon piece of you that was stimulated by just the pure beauty of what that story was, and then. After Hamilton, like that also fed my energy coming into 2018, and then seeing Black Panther, and then seeing not just the movie, which was a fantastic piece of work, it was effortless, which means that a lot of work went into it. Clearly. But then just seeing all the black folk, and you know, without spoiling it, the scene when Daniel, what's his name, from Get Out, I always say his name wrong.
Oh, yeah. You know, I can never say his name either.
Right. When he kneels in front of Danai Gurira after the rhino attack, and when he drops his weapon, all the theater, most of the black people in the theater started clapping.
Right.
Because it was such a refutation of toxic masculinity, you know, which is why I think really the core of Black Panther is a refutation of toxic masculinity. Mm. And I think that's where... I think so many people are, because toxic masculinity is destroying the planet, period. The fact that we treat women the way we treat women, the fact we treat the indigenous the way we treat the indigenous, we treat the stolen how we treat the stolen, I feel that this film shows you how to tell a story with these people without centralizing making it poverty porn, which is what I'm tired of that too.
Right.
But at the same time, you don't forget that these people were struggling, but you also centralize their humanity. It was not sitting around white man this, white man that, which you know can get boring too. Yeah. You know,
I don't think there was a line in there about
colonizer, bullshit. Which was my favorite.
Colonizer. Yeah,
that was the best slur I've ever seen. I was like, wow, that's a slur without being a slur, right? Exactly. But
there was some backhands.
Yeah, right. But I just feel like the beauty of who we are, and Lupita Nyong'o said this in the interview, which I've been watching all the interviews. Right. She was like, it was a Pan-African scene when they did the waterfall scene with the warrior waterfall they call it. She said, and you can find this on YouTube, she talks about how there were people from Sierra Leone, Cote d'Ivoire, Ghana, Nigeria, South Africa, East Africa.
Well, even the elders, they represented all those different...
But in real world, like in terms of the physical actors, they were saying that they were they were people from every aspect of the diaspora on that set that day. And they were doing, and she was freestyling. This is what she said, that because who else talked about this? Winston Duke, who played M'Baku, Daniel Kaluuya, they were talking about... Now, it was an interview right after that when they were talking about Lupita having freestyle skills. And they said that they were playing Drop It Like It's Hot on drums. And all the people on the waterfall were saying, over and over again. Yeah, yeah. And she said that...
They got to have that on film.
They have to. Somebody had to record. But they were saying that moment was like the magical moment. Because every set has a magical moment. That was the magical moment when you had the Pan-African experience singing a hip-hop song.
Wow.
And Lupita was freestyling. You know, and they were playing.
She got bars, huh?
Yeah, everyone was stunned. And there's video of that. I think her rapping someplace too. Yeah, yeah.
I know someone has SD camera or their phone or something recording that.
Yeah, they had to have. So I mean, Ryan Coogler might have. You know, so I just feel like that. we are vibing off the fact that we're seeing ourselves finally as who we are. Because one of the things I always argue about, and this is something that I get in a lot of trouble for, where I always say that they make us seem poorer than we actually are. And what I mean by that is that there's all these poverty statistics and numbers, but then my reality doesn't show that all black people are poor and suffering and starving.
Correct.
There is problems in our communities. We know that. But the majority of the black community gets up and goes to work every single day like everybody else. We generate, what is it, $1.2 trillion a year? So how could everybody being on welfare generate $1.2 trillion a year?
No way.
Like, if black people became their own country, I forgot where we would be in the GDP, but we would be pretty... we'd be in a pretty good spot, like a second world nation status. And that's African Americans by themselves. So one of the things that drives me crazy is the poverty porn, the over expectation of weakness, the refuge, the denial of our own excellence. Because when I took that picture, well, I didn't take the picture, but when I posted the picture on, which is the best performing picture I've ever put up on Twitter, I have almost 2,000 likes. Really? I have never gotten 2,000 likes for anything I've ever posted, no matter how positive or awesome. I always get, I probably top off at about 70 likes.
Right.
Historically, and I got like damn near 2,000 for that. Yeah. So, and I put a little thing about how everybody in this shot is a showrunner or a screenwriter of acclaim or have achieved something. Every man in that photo, right? And I think we're just tired of hearing we're nothing all the time. You know, like the Black Men Smiling hashtag, which went up about 2 weeks ago. I found it by accident. And even as, and I always make this, as a straight black man, I still like seeing black men happy.
Right.
You know?
Right.
You know, because it's always, you know, some weirdness because people are, you know, some people have some issues in themselves. But anytime, like there was a shot with Ryan Coogler and Michael B. Jordan on Essence a couple, like a year and a half or two years ago, and he's touching them. Yes. Everyone was making a big deal. I'm like, so we can't be affectionate toward other black men without being called gay?
Yes.
And not that there's, not that that's a problem, but I'm like, this is where people's heads at. The fact that black men are hugging each other or smiling or being tender, not shooting each other or calling each other nigger 24/7. That means that you're gay because you love your brother? Like, well, I mean, and I'm just saying, like, to me, I think this is what Black Panther is the antidote for. I think that everyone has wanted for so long just to see us not be pathological. And I think for me, because there was no pathology in it. Even Killmonger's point of view, which I absolutely agree with. I don't agree with his misogyny. But I get what he was saying. Like, yo, all of us have been suffering. You guys had the weapons. We could have won. Because my beef, and this as a comic book geek, I was never a fan of Black Panther as a character. Because I always thought to myself, why didn't the Wakandans do anything during the transatlantic slave trade? That has always been my argument.
Interesting.
Because they had the ability to stop it.
They were
it
taking
all.
Them from Africa. So, right? They read
so I've always had a problem with Black Panther because it goes into that. And this, the movie didn't do this. And some people think it did, but I don't think it did. But there has been that whole noble African versus African American thug, you know, a Black American thug type of discourse that's gone on since before I was born. And even in Baltimore growing up, recent African immigrants would kind of look down on us. And there would always be this kind of weirdness with
there
that. But I didn't.
There's a lot of that.
Yeah, there is. But I didn't feel, even though some people say it's there, I didn't feel it. I didn't feel that there. I just felt that he had a point of view because of the PTSD of being a black person in the United States. And that what, like, it's like, this is what the U.S. does to people. You know, white men, black men, white women, people, women, you know, the U.S., our culture creates PD, is a post-traumatic stress disorder culture because we hurt people so much. There's so much, like, look at the shooting, you know, in Florida. God bless the, you know, God bless everyone who survived and sadly the ones who passed. But just the reaction to it from the other side, like the nasty side. Like, there are people attacking the children who survived on Twitter.
What?
Yeah, yeah. There are, Fox News put up a thing which showed a young girl with a short haircut saying, we don't want to take this anymore. And these Fox News zombies are like, well, you know, we have our guns for a reason. If you don't like it, get out of here. You know, I don't know if they really sound like that, but that's in my mind. That's what it sounds like. But I always go back to what Michael Moore talked about. Right? Michael Moore in Bowling for Columbine said it best, that the reason why white Americans need their guns is because they, in the back of their head, they think we're all coming for them. They 24/7 believe, not everyone, right. but there's this belief.
Like we did that, in South Africa, right?
Right. Yeah, the truth exactly. of, you know, but there's a belief that there's such a fear. We're a fear-based society. I always talk about this. And the way to get rid of guns is to get rid of our fear. And the one movie, the one scene in the movie I would suggest everyone watch. I mean, first of all, everyone should watch Network and read Paddy Chayefsky's screenplay. Read the screenplay, watch the movie. Right. Network explains why the news is the way it is, as propaganda. Then there was a movie that came out with Jake Gyllenhaal called Nightcrawler a couple years ago. I think it was a year and a half ago, right? And there's a moment
Which he got shafted from the nomination.
Dude, he was so good! Anyway, that man is bad. That dude, that boy is bad. Anyway, don't get me started on that. That cat can act. That boy can act. There's a scene with him and Rene Russo, who plays the news director, and she says something like, yeah, we always lead with this stuff because it scares white people. Because white people watch local. I don't watch local news anymore, but every now and then I'll tune into KTLA, and I'll be like, okay, let's see what the weather's going to be like. And it's like, oh, some gangbang, some cholo gangbanger shot up somebody, or somebody beat up a little late. And I'm like, of all the things you could report, you have to put a black or Latino face doing something bad at the top of your broadcast. I mean, that's a fear-based thing. There's a great book, and I'll shut up after this. It's a book called The Culture of Fear by Barry Glassner. Again, The Culture of Fear by Barry Glassner, who's a UCLA sociology professor. He said, and this is back in the late 90s, early 2000s. It's like 2003, actually, when he said this, that crime has gone down, like, he said, like 70%, but the reporting of crime has gone up 100-something%.
Damn.
So
that's a good quote,
And yesterday I saw a tweet, and I wish I could find it, where crime is at an all-time low again, but people are more afraid now than they ever have been.
Right.
Child abductions are actually not as ubiquitous as everyone believes, but no one lets their kid go outside, despite the fact that most kids will never be it. Because in theory, in the 80s, I should have been raped and abducted every single day, because I would go outside for 13 hours a day and no one knew where we were.
I had no idea.
And I used to play in abandoned construction sites. Right. And somehow I've made it to here. Right. So I feel that so much of anti-black bigotry is based upon fear. Mm-hmm. And one thing I love about Black Panther, it is not a fear-based movie. You know what I mean? And I think that's another thing, is that when you see the absence of fear, finally, that's something that people don't want to be afraid. Like, we go see scary movies. That's one thing. That's a controlled experiment. But life? Who wants to get up and think everyone's out to get me all the time? And I do believe, and this is my sociology side talking, historically, from day one, white working class to white poor have been told that blacks are their enemies. And this is why you see Fox News gain such an advantage. This is why the guns sell. Mm-hmm. So go back to Bowling for Columbine.
They're selling more.
And read Culture of Fear by Barry Glassner. Right. And then,
that's what's up. Cool, man. Good episode. Where are you at, Brandon?
I am on Twitter, at Brandon Easton. I've also created an Instagram presence showing my workout routine. I'm at Brandon Easton Writer on Instagram. Thank you, sir. And I'm also on Facebook, but I have been taking a break from Facebook. I've only been posting like major positive things. You know, I spent way too much time on Facebook over the years arguing with complete morons. Right. I'm not doing it anymore. Good. I'm just posting things that I want to post and talk about positive things. Right. And my Twitter feed is the same way. So come on over to my Twitter. It's at Brandon Easton. Brandon Easton Writer on Instagram and Brandon.Easton on Facebook.
Cool. Thank you. Where you at, Chris?
I am on Twitter and Instagram, same handle, at UnauthorizedCBD.
That's what's up.
I talk about, you know, movies and shit. Every once in a while, I'll chime in on some craziness about the politics. You know, like I chimed in on about the shooting in Florida.
Mm-hmm. Right, you have to.
Because, my thing is, why is this news? We don't care about this situation, so why even report it? Mm. We're not going to change it because we're not going to change the laws. Mm. After this thing in Sandy Hook, since there's no change from there, there's going to be no change.
Right. But however, that generation is voting this year. The Florida, this is the one positive, that those kids have become radicalized against the NRA. Mm. And if Mueller's investigation is going to do what I think it's going to do, the NRA may be in some trouble.
Right. They need to be in trouble.
I'll leave it at that.
That is that. And I'm your host, Hilliard Guest. You guys can find me on Twitter at Hilliard Guest. You guys can follow the show, Screenwriters RR, on Twitter. Any questions, screenwritersrantroom@gmail.com. Please go on iTunes, give us a 5-star review. We need that for the metrics. And shit like that. That's what's up. Follow us on Facebook too. So thank y'all. This was a good episode. Yeah, that was fun. That's good. A lot of game in that one. A lot of game.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you.
It's great to be back, man. It's been a while.
Thank you for coming through. Yeah. So you know how we do it on the Rant Room. And we keep it real. We keep it opinionated. We keep it what y'all.
Wakanda.
Peace.
I'ma say what I feel. And I promise to keep it real.
Welcome to the Rant Room. Well, you gotta be a rider till your fears are diminishing, the doubts are behind ya. It's hard to grind and the business got me stressed. In the Rant Room, we let that shit up off our chest. You know the street nerd has got no time for no caca. Sass in class, yes, that's Mr. Bolakaja. Never have to guess when you're listening to Hilliard. He gon' bring more game than a shark playing billiards. It's all about the crap of screenwriting. It's exciting when you turn an outline into something enlightening. Your pen and words are like bullets in a gun. Write what you feel, say what you want.
Welcome to the Rant Room.